Those of you who are parents at one time or another listened in on your children's conversations with an especially keen ear when they were young to figure out if they're talking in code about something that you should know about. But it's another way you listen when they become young adults. Last year, I was listening in on one of those conversations between my son and some of his college-age buddies as they were talking about what they did in the last quarter, the last semester of their senior year, when they needed just a handful of credits to have all of their requirements for graduation, all the work in their major area of study had been done. And so they could take anything they wanted. And so they started sharing about some of the unusual courses that they took. And the winner went to Tony, who graduated from Indiana University, and he took a course called Chivalry and Courtliness. Now, that could come in real handy should you wake up one morning and find that you have got into a wormhole and transferred back into the medieval era, and so you would have everything you needed to know to get by because you know chivalry and courtliness. Any chivalrous men around here? Bill, do you know how to be courtly? Talk to Tony. He can tell you all about it. And I was thinking about this. I decided I was going to look up some of the unusual to weird classes that you can take at our universities and colleges. At the University of Pennsylvania, you can take a class called Wasting Time on the Internet. And I can see the syllabus right now. Students shall waste time on the Internet. Of course, there's a little bit more to that. It was really a class in sociology. At the University of Southern California, you can take a class called Selfies, where the students are required to take 5 selfies of themselves and then write essays about what those photographs say in ways that either produce or obscure their identities. If you want to go down to Center College in Kentucky, you can take a course called The Art of Walking. Now, I know that a lot of you walk for exercise and enjoyment. And in this course, they walk students through parks and public gardens and museums and through cemeteries to keep them from being so absolutely, compulsively, constantly focused upon doing things all of the time, and to instead slow themselves down such that they can experience life for a change. At Santa Clara University in California, you can take a course called The Joy of Garbage, where you spend the course literally digging through piles of garbage as archaeologists, trying to figure out, okay, what would this item that I have retrieved from the junk pile say about the culture that produced it? And what does their search the garbage say about how we regard waste and how we treat the environment? With the El Nikis, you got one in, I think it's upstate New York. You know where Alfred University is? You can take a course at that school simply called Maple Syrup, where you learn everything you want to know, and I'm sure it's a class that's offered in spring. Learn everything you want to know about processing maple syrup. And if you don't want to go to Pennsylvania or New York or California or Kentucky, you can go right downstate to Vincennes University, where they take bowling very seriously. They not only have a class, but they have a major called Bowling Industry Management. Everything you could possibly know about bowling yourself or teaching others to bowl, how to run a bowling alley, or just how to be a goodwill ambassador for the sport of bowling wherever you go. But as I went through these classes, there was one that really stood out. It's offered at Yale University, both in their undergraduate school and also in the Divinity School. And it's called Life Worth Living. I think that should be a required course for every human being. What is it that gives your life meaning and purpose and fulfillment? Let me just throw that one out to you this morning. What makes your life worth living? You can think about it a little bit. What makes it worth getting out of bed every morning and going to work or doing whatever it is you do and going to bed and thinking back on your day and feeling like you have done something significant? What is it that gives your life a sense of worth? Love. Okay, that's good. KC?
Making?
Creating? Yeah. I think solving for you the problems?
My Christian family, yeah.
The Christian family?
Grandchildren?
Grandchildren? For me, family yesterday, marrying my daughter, and let me tell you, that was a weird, weird experience. What makes your life worth living?
Russell.
Paula, you don't tell him that. Everybody else this morning, tell Russell what makes Paula's life worth living. And one of the things that this course does is it talks about meaning that is rooted in traditions. Family traditions, societal traditions, and Tom, as you said, in the tradition of your Christian faith, or if you are of some other religious tradition within that. Your worth comes by living your life within a structure, within a set of beliefs. Because meaning and worth is not something that we can create on our own. Just to say, I think that I'm going to be worth living because of X, Y, and Z. I don't remember which ancient philosopher who said it, but he said, an unexamined life, you know, the rest of it is not worth living. If you don't stop to ponder, maybe as Mary pondered all of those things that were happening to her at the life of Jesus, if you don't ponder, if you don't reflect, if you don't meditate on the significance of your life and who you are now and who you want to be and where your life is going, then you are missing something very essential to what it means to be a human being. What gives your life worth? What gets you out of bed? What keeps you going? What keeps you from putting a gun to your head and saying, it's not worth it at all, I'm just going to end it right now? I want to look at Galatians a little bit. Galatia was not a city, unlike some of the other places where Paul's ministry was situated. Galatia was a region or an area in which there were various Christian fellowships which had been established. Paul had gone there himself to establish those churches. He presented the gospel of Jesus Christ as it had been given to him. But as is often the case, when after Paul had established the church and moved on, somebody else came in behind him to give their own version or their own unique take on it. In some cases, it was what we call the Judaizers, who were coming in to try to dispel that belief altogether, or to so mix Judaism and Christianity that the person came out more Jewish than Christian. Or there are others called the Gnostics, who claim to have special spiritual knowledge that elevated them above others, and that the whole goal of becoming a Christian was to have that special kind of knowledge, the kind that you could have because you were a member of some exclusive club. And Paul did not like that at all. And so he writes this letter to clear up all of the confusion and the dissension that is being sown in the churches of Galatia. And he does that by a very interesting way. He recalls his past. It was not a good past. You know, what if you're a salesman, what is the most important thing you have to do in working with a client? Marv, you were in sales. Some of you others. What's the most important thing that a salesperson must do? You service to the customer. What are you really selling? Yourself. You're not selling, you're selling a service. You're not necessarily selling a product, but first of all, you have to sell yourself. You have to be a credible person. Does this individual have character? Can I trust this individual? In one of the churches I served, we had a car salesman. Very well known throughout the community for his integrity and ethics. He worked for some of the auto firms that had their commercials all over the television set, but he quit from several of them because they were asking him to do things and to employ sales practices that he said were unethical, and he would have no part in it. And so, naturally, he had a lot of customers, a lot of repeat customers. The children of customers would come to buy cars from Ron. I would say that probably well over half of the cars in the church parking lot were sold by Ron. Because you knew you weren't going to haggle over the price of a car. You would sit down, you would tell him what you want. What's the best you can do for me? He would write it out, sold. Now that is trust. That comes from selling yourself, being a trustworthy person. And so this was the task that Paul had in all of the churches, but in this case in Galatia. And he was brandishing his credentials. He said, if there was a Jew's Jew, it was me. No one knew the scriptures better than I did. No one could have a command of the law right at the snap of a finger like I did. I had no equal. And then he went on to say that out of that passionate, zealous faith, he saw it as his responsibility to eradicate the church, to oversee the stoning of Christians. You remember in the book of Acts, where Paul is present at the stoning of Stephen. And imagine using that as your sales pitch. I was once a persecutor of Christianity, and now I'm its chief proclaimer. This is who I was, but by virtue of my dramatic encounter with Jesus Christ on the Damascus Road that knocked me off my horse and struck me blind and instructed me in what I should do with my life. It was out of all of that that everything changed. I had a whole new value structure in my life. I was given worth and meaning all because of Jesus Christ. I once was wrong, but now I proclaim to you the one who is the hope of the world. And forget what all these other charlatans are telling you. I'm telling you that this is what the central affirmation of the gospel of Jesus is, Christ is. You can trust me. I'm presenting it to you in its wholeness and in its entirety. If there was a verse that summed up this passionate belief in Paul, he said, Christ in me is to live. And you remember the second half of that verse? Christ in me to live, to die is to gain. When I let go of myself, when I let Jesus Christ be the meaning maker, that is when I have my worth. Y'all remember, well, some of you won't remember, but a lot of you will remember George Wallace, the governor of Alabama, the one who stood at the front steps of a school to forbid children of color from coming in. He was a staunch segregationist. In 1968, I believe it was, he ran for president. I was aghast because my grandfather voted for him. Said he would be the best thing that ever happened to this country, but now, Carol will understand when I say this. My grandfather was a hillbilly, and I say that in a loving way. He was from the sticks. He grew up in a log cabin with 10 brothers and sisters. He had a hard life. His father taught him how to swim by taking him to the Ohio River and throwing him in. Sink or swim. He was a hillbilly. And he loved George Wallace. He wouldn't come out and really say he hated black people. But I think that deep down he did. You remember as George Wallace was campaigning that there was an assassination attempt which left him paralyzed. Do you remember what George Wallace was doing during the end of his life? He was visiting African-American congregations to tell them he was sorry. To say that that which provided meaning and worth in my life was totally wrong. And he came before them as a very, very courageous thing to do. Talk about being vulnerable. To sit before the very people that you had persecuted and say, I was wrong. Will you please forgive me? George Wallace was a man who discovered what made life worth living. Now, what are the ways that you know that you are living out of a sense of meaning and purpose? It's when you go about your life in such a way that you don't have time to stop and reflect. Well, what is the meaning of my life? Because you enjoy what you're doing so much and you find so much significance in what you do that you don't have time to reflect. You know that a lot of mental illness, not all of us, but a significant part of mental illness comes from people who cannot stop thinking about their lives. And what is it that gives meaning? And they're searching in all of these sources, and it becomes an obsessive thing. And the more they obsess about it, the less healthy they become, and they never come close to finding out what that meaning is. Albert Sabin and Jonas Salk, who were they? Okay, everybody can say polio vaccine. It was Jonas Salk that discovered the vaccine that would kill polio. And Albert Sabin was the one who created the delivery system for that. I can remember when I was a little child standing in a long line going into the Veterans Memorial Coliseum in Marion, Ohio, and finally getting up to this table that had hundreds of these little white paper cups. Did any of you remember doing that? Two of us were in that niche. Millions, literally millions of cases of polio were prevented because of Sabin and Salk. Did you know that they never took out a patent on their vaccine? They didn't make a dollar off of their gift to the world. You know, they could have, but they chose not to because the world needed it. And they had the knowledge to avert that. And Sabin said, "My biggest satisfaction in life was relieving human suffering. And the world would be a much better place if every person did their part without thinking of what the return would be for them." I would love to take Sabin and Salk into the board of directors meeting at Roche and Eli Lilly and say, "You have drugs that will save people's lives, and you are charging $1,000 for a pill. People are dying because they cannot afford your medication." I think it was several years ago, Johnson & Johnson had developed a vaccine to be used for sheep. I don't remember what the vaccine prevented, but farmers, veterinarians could get that drug for cents, C-E-N-T-S. And they discovered that the very same vaccine could be used in human beings to treat whatever the illness was, I don't remember. The very same drug, and they increased the cost 700%. Now, you tell me where meaning is in that. That is doing good for a profit. See, when you know what you're meant to do, things which once seemed like a very big deal lose their luster. And wrestling with what makes life important is precisely because there is so much in this world that is not worthy of our identity as the children of God. Think about the ideas that with which we were raised about money. For some people, money is salvation. The things that matter most, money can buy. If I only had his money, I would, and complete the phrase. Dick was a guy who always had something up his sleeve. He had a lot of rental properties. He made numerous business investments. He played poker with the boys every Friday night. He was always looking for a way to make a buck. Now, his wife, Eileen, was a saint, if there ever was one. One of the most dedicated, beautiful Christian women you would ever want to meet, whose job it was to pick up eight widows every Sunday morning to bring them to church. Widow's Row, we called it. But Dick never set foot in the church, and so I was surprised when he called for me to come when he was on his deathbed. And when I walked into the room, Dick started crying, and I immediately thought to myself, okay, now he's come to realize that money can't help him now.
And so I held his hand for a while, and I said, "Dick, is there something you're regretting?" And he sobbed, "Yes." And he sobbed that, "I am so sad I didn't make a better investment on that business venture, and I could have made a lot more money." I had said up to that point in my life that I had never met an individual who on their deathbed said they wished they could have had more money, and he blew that one to smithereens. What is your life worth? I want to read something for you. It's called "The Meaning of Life" in three words. It goes like this: all is one. Wrong. All is nothing. Wrong. Say wrong with me, shall we? That makes it more impressive that way. Drives it home. Just be yourself. Wrong. Follow your heart. Wrong. All is illusion. Wrong. All is love. Wrong. Be here now. Okay? I am God. I am money. I am nobody. Bliss being consciousness. I am that. All is mind. All is emptiness. All is Buddha. All is enlightenment. Tic-tac-toe. I don't know. Right. I don't know. Did you ever stop to think about maybe your meaning in life is derived from saying, "I just don't know. There are forces that are bigger than me that are operative in this world. There is so much of God that I simply do not know." Without a doubt, this prayer that I'm going to share with you is one of the most powerful I have ever encountered. If you read about it in some places, it's entitled "The Prayer That Everyone Can Pray." It was prayed by a Catholic monk named Thomas Merton, who lived at the Gethsemane Abbey down in Kentucky. He lived 25 years all by himself in a little hut at the back of that monastery. Sarah was there one time. Ask her about it. He gave the world so many incredibly rich books about the spiritual life, and I want you to listen to this prayer, especially in light of finding worth in "I don't know." "My Lord God, I have no idea where I am going. I do not know the road ahead of me, and I do not know for certain where it will end. Nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think I am following your will does not actually mean that I am doing so. But Lord, I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you, and I hope that I have that desire in all that I am doing. I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire. And I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the right road. Now listen to this: though I may know nothing about it, you may lead me by the right road, and I may not know anything about it. Therefore will I trust you always. Though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death, I will not fear, because you are ever near me, and you will never, never leave me to face my perils alone." Could that be your prayer? I know that it's mine. I keep coming back to it again and again. If you want to look it up, it's called The Road Ahead by Thomas Merton. You know, we can give our all to God and to serving Jesus Christ, and yet right up until the end, not really be sure if you have done what you were supposed to do. But what a profound thing it is to have such faith that God knows what you were about, and that perhaps God has been using you in ways in which you did not have a clue, and which you will never know until you meet God in glory. Christ complicated Paul's life. After he met him on the Damascus Road, it got a lot harder. He went from being the persecutor to the persecuted. And if you look in Corinthians, he has this long list of all his hardships and all of the things he endured and all the times he was thrown in the pokey. And we look at that life, particularly in those times when the dark seems so deep that we will never be able to penetrate it, and when it feels like we are at a loss and in the shadow of death, and we find ourselves saying, what does it mean? We can only come down to one thing. My life only has meaning as it's rooted in God's will, in loving God, in following Jesus, and living and loving my life for his sake. Amen.